Next case is 98-17-79, 98-19-29, State of Ohio versus Daniel Conyers, State of Ohio versus Charles Schultz.
Versus the singular.
Slim Dickens, if that's how you can.
Maybe. Just a few things, right? I'm going to fix this so I get it.
Why don't you do that? Why don't you do this? Because it's a conduct to the job.
Oh, I took it right in the firm, that's what I'm saying. But you won't have to go through many propositions at all.
It's coming.
It's true.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Phil Cummings. I'm here at the County Prosecutor's Office today on the case of State v. Schultz. I'm going to be sharing the podium this morning with my colleague from Lucas County Prosecutor's Office, Mr. Rick Bowne. We might go a lot of time as follows. I'll speak for approximately 6 minutes. Mr. Bowne will speak for five. We would like to reserve four for the vote.
Need to watch your time on the clock.
Thank you. Your Honors, I know you've read the briefs. And I don't want to spend a lot of time going over the facts because I know you know why we are here. Briefly, the legislature amended the detention definition in the chapter on 2921 on October 1996 and changed that definition to include those people on parole who are supervised by the adult parole authority. Previously, that very definition of section had expressly excluded parolees from that term detention. As a result of this change, parolees could now be charged with escape if they absconded from supervision. Now, unfortunately, that change conflicted with a statute in the parole section of the code, 2967.15. And I want to be clear and candid up front, it's a clear conflict. One section said you could charge parolees with escape, and the other, in essence, was saying you cannot charge parolees with escape. It's the state's position, we maintain that this is just an oversight on the legislature's part as far as not tweaking that section in the parole section of the code.
Let's start with a couple of, to really clarify it for me. If the parole section, the parole statute and the escape statute were both the same and accepted parolees from escape, and this had occurred, this breaking detention had occurred during that period of time, there'd be no question. Is that right?
Correct.
There'd be no escape.
Correct.
Okay. If both statutes had been amended subsequently, and then he broke detention, there'd be no question.
Correct.
So we're at the point where the escape statute was amended, the parole section was not amended, and the detention was broken.
Correct.
Right. Now, I understand the argument of intent and the General Assembly's intent. Understand taking the specific over the general, all those arguments. My concern is, don't we construe those statutes against the state?
I'm glad you asked that question. I think that is certainly one of the rules this court has to use, but it's the state's position that you do use that presumption of lenity in favor of the accused when it almost says, as a resort, when you can't solve the problem by application of the rules of statutory construction. I think if this court still faces ambiguity after applying the rules of statutory construction, then I think the rule of lenity would provide the answer. I would certainly concede that. But it's the state's position here. The good news is that this issue is really a straightforward statutory construction issue, and it can be solved by application of statutory construction rule 1.51 and 1.52. So this court need not get to that general rule of lenity, which would kick in ultimately if the issue is still ambiguous. But
you're saying that the statute is not ambiguous and they are not in conflict. That's your argument, as I understand it.
No, I'm saying that the two statutes at the time were definitely in conflict. Definitely, I believe that the intent of the legislature was not to have that be the case, but unfortunately. just by a very simple application of the rule 1.52A, when you have conflicting statutes, the one later in an accident controls, I think, is dispositive here. Similarly, I think statutory rule 1.51 also leads this court to the very same result, because we do have a general conflicting with the special. In a situation, though, where the general is later in enactment and the intent of the legislature is clear and it's meant to control. And let me explain to the court why I say that the intent is clear. I think there's at least five factors that support that statement. Number one, there was a definite purposeful deletion of the language in the detention section, which had priorly excluded parolees from being charged with escape. That was a purposeful deletion. This court has found a similar purposeful deletion to be valid in the sense of safety Chippendale, where this court said that there was a deletion, it had a purpose, we're going to give effect to the legislature's intent in deleting that language.
And that's where that follows, that then the court must delete from another statute what the General Assembly did not do. So we're going to construe what they meant to enact rather than what they had enacted?
Well, that's, I understand what you're saying. It's similar to the comment, I think, in State versus Frost, where I know this court is reluctant to apply to the repeal legislation. I understand the question. And I think that if this court looks to its decision in State versus Frost, it's destructive. And it does lead to the same conclusion, though, that the state maintains here for this reason. In State versus Frost, unlike here, there was not the manifest legislative intent to have a change. In State versus Frost, this court was not presented with that subsequent amendment that you have here, that happened in March of 98, which confirmed really what the legislature was doing in October of 96. So the law of Frost is valid, and it has applied. It still can support the state's position, because the law of Frost will not impliedly repeal an act unless the intent is there. And that's the whole state's whole position here, is that this is a case where the intent of the legislature is such that it's clear that they meant this, they meant for parolees to be charged with escape.
But how can we do that if there's no ambiguity that would suggest we could just delete a phrase? How would we get to intent by repealing words of a statute?
Well, I can give you five ways to get there.
Mm-hmm.
The first one is they did a very purposeful deletion. And
in another section.
In a very general definitional section of 2921, it was not a specific statute area. It was a general, broad, definitional section meant to have widespread application throughout the code. Secondly, the two statutes are so directly in conflict that they couldn't coexist. It's the state's position that clear conflict evidences the fact that the legislature was purposely trying to do something. They didn't do this in vain. They didn't consciously neutralize themselves. They wanted to be effective. They meant to be effective. They just made an oversight.
When we get to this conflict, the escape statute isn't the conflict. It's the definition of detention. So we get there through that general definition of intention. You get to conflict. And yet, the conflicting statute doesn't use the word detention. The statute that you claim conflicts uses the in custody, that is considered to be in custody while on furlough or et cetera.
Right.
So do we get to the conflict? Do we first have to say that the fact that the word detention isn't even used in the conflicting statute, how do we resolve that first?
Well, if this court gives effect to the words of the statute, the redefinition of detention and the escape provision, if this court gives effect to the words of those statutes, clearly parolees are now subject to escape charges.
Are custody and detention the very same thing? It's just 2967.15 does not mention the word detention, and it does mention escape, but it defines who is considered to be in custody.
I understand your question, and we think that is something that's not come up.
Mm-hmm.
It's been assumed by, I think, everyone.
That it's the same deal.
Of course, it's had the equivalent meaning.
Mm-hmm.
They're in detention, and they're either chargeable or not. I don't want to step on my colleague's time.
I'm sorry.
If I may, you'll vote him down, and I can turn the
second. Second, Mr. Cummings. Mr. Bond.
Mr. Bond, I'd just like to return briefly to my first question, because I'd like to get your thought on it, too. Here we've got, in my first example, the two statutes being the same, defendant wins 100%. If they were both the same, deletion, having deletions, and he then broke detention, state wins 100%. Here we've got the state winning 50% and him winning 50%. Why doesn't the tie go to the defendant under liberal construction?
Well, as Mr. Cummings explained, the rule of lenity only applies to men applying the, utilizing the rule of statutory construction. There is no answer. There is no way to resolve the problem. In that case, the tie does go to the runner. In this case, the defendant. And here, however, we have the purposeful deletion. This court in Chippendale, on page 122 of the book, that opinion specifically referred to a purposeful deletion as indicative of legislative intent in that regard. And we also have, as Judge Norman pointed out in the dissenting opinion in State versus Schultz, the timing and the circumstances in the broader context of Senate Bill 2, in which this entire dispute arose. And fourth, we have the subsequent March 1998 amendment of the parole provision and in the Lucas County's recently submitted list of supplemental authorities. I refer to the subtly treatise on statutory instruction. I refer to two appellate decisions, also one was the Ford Motor Company case, and the other one was a criminal case, State versus Schultz from Pickaway County, and they all ruled that subsequent amendments to legislation, given the timing, circumstances, and the context, can be viewed as amending previous statutes, not creating new law. So for those reasons, I suspectfully submit that the rule of lenity in this context today does not apply. That said, I would like to advance to the state's second proposition of law. Because of time constraints, I plan to waive argument on our third proposition of law to add that on the briefs. The second proposition of law is framed in the alternative. It's not intended to undercut or to compromise our first proposition of law. It's in the alternative. And in the alternative, despite the discussion we've had in the past 5 or 10 minutes, it is not even necessary to resort to Revised Code Section 1.51 to reconcile these two statutes. Section 1.51 applies only when there genuinely is a general provision and there genuinely is a specific exception to it. And in this context, the escape statute is simply not a general provision, and the parole statute is simply not an exception to it. And again, I want to refer to Chippendale for another reason now, where this court was asked to balance the involuntary manslaughter statute, as codified in 2903.104b, against the aggravated vehicle homicide provision, which is codified in 2903.106. In weighing those two statutes against each other, the court noted that the involuntary manslaughter statute, which defines causing the death of another during the commission of a misdemeanor, is a broad, general provision. It applies whenever someone causes the death while committing a misdemeanor. Doesn't matter what they're doing, doesn't matter what the act is, the defendant simply has to be committing a misdemeanor. In contrast, the aggravated vehicular statute, it was held to be the essential provision because it concerned only causing the death of another, specifically while operating a motor vehicle. And of significance is the fact that in the general provision, the involuntary manslaughter provision, there is no specific mention of the of operating a motor vehicle, which is why the court held the way they did. I see my time is running out. I want to raise another case decided by this court, State versus Bull. I don't have the time to discuss it, but the court applied the same rules and the same pattern and holding itself in Bull as it did in Skisdale. Now, to answer the question, I'm sure it's looming. The escape statute is not a general statute, and the parole statute is not a specific statute, because they both address the exact same question. That being whether a parolee can be charged with escape. Since they address the exact same question, as opposed to one outlining a broad principle and the other outlining a specific exception to it, 1.51 simply does not apply. Instead, we must use 1.52a to resolve this dispute. And the escape statute, being the more recently amended provision, should be allowed to prevail. Finally, this approach is consistent with sound public policy. Section 1.51 should be used sparingly, because if it's not, it would set the precedent for anyone to torture legislative intent simply by combing through the voluminous Ohio Revised Code, finding some ancient, archaic provision, slapping a special label on it, and allowing it to prevail over a far more recently enacted, more relevant provision. This would obviously, as I said earlier, torture legislative intent and ultimately lead to absurd results. For that reason, the Lucas County Prosecutor's Office respectfully requests this court to sustain its second and third assignment of errors and reverse the decision of the Sixth District Court of Appeals.
Thank you, Mr. Baum. Mr. Clark.
Good morning, Your Honor. May I please report? I'll be sharing the podium with Mr. Jeff Gamso this morning. So what I'd like to do is I'll give approximately 7 minutes. Mr. Gamso, I'll give the podium to him and finish the argument, so I'll watch the time here. I think I want to address the first issue that's apparently come up. It appears to be the court's immediate concern is what rules of statutory construction do we apply? And I think when you talk about specific versus general rules of construction, the prosecutor's office seems to kind of miss the boat on. We have a rule of lenity, as they call it, is codified in the revised code. That's a very specific rule of construction. The rules that apply in criminal cases and crime statutes and penalties are to be strictly construed against the state. That's the starting point. From there, then you can look at the rest of the rules of construction, because that's a specific rule of construction that applies here, because it's a criminal case. It's not a civil case. So when you apply that rule as the filter, then apply 1.51, 1.52, you still have to come back to the very basic proposition that at the time of these offenses, there was a specific statutory provision that said you cannot prosecute somebody in the role for a state. The state wants to have the case, wants to see the two, because now they say you should give effect to what the legislature meant to do. But if you look at the history behind that particular provision, 2967, that was amended when Senate Bill 2 was amended to criminal code overhaul. It was only 4 months later that the definition of detention was changed. When that definition was changed, this court held the legislature is presumed to know what it's already enacted. Very clearly, it enacted a provision that said you cannot be prosecuted or escape if you're on parole. At the point in time, basically the trial level, there were holders placed on them pending the resolution of this. To be honest with you, I didn't do the trial work. I don't know if Mr. Schultz's parole was actually violated with the return to the institution or not.
Someone doesn't show up on probation or somebody comes back to halfway out of the PDCF. There still is a pretty heavy penalty hanging over them as their original sentence gets.
I agree, Your Honor, and I think that is one of the reasons the court can look to say that the legislature did not, at the time of these conflicting provisions enacted, necessarily intend prosecution for escape to be around, because they could still be violated for a full violation. not following directions of the officer, not reporting whatever the technical rule violation was that they broke. The fact that they now have a highly non-penalty, so to speak, now because you're on parole, you can be prosecuted for escape. And the second burden, so they're in effect going back to what would happen if you were in custody, you committed a crime, you're in the jail, and you're probably dead. That's where it puts. But there's a secondary remedy with the parole authority revoking these people's parole. I think the point that Justice Cook made about giving effect to what the legislature did instead of what they intended to do is clear, because had they intended this result when they originally modified 2967, they could have changed it at that time, and they did not. And these changes are made in the sweeping Senate Bill 2 legislation, and they very carefully went through every other criminal code section, and they didn't change it. Here, they didn't need to. By modifying the term detention to now include parolees, there's an alternative purpose that the legislature also served and created, because there's now also an offense where a person on parole cannot possess a firearm, where without that definitional change in the term detention, parolees could. I think that people within outside conditions of parole, possess a firearm may not be a separate criminal offense.
Do we need to have to ignore the code provision for the parolee can?
I don't think it's necessarily a question of ignoring that provision, because there's no provision that says to do that. But what I think you have to look at is the escape statute is a specific statute that prohibits certain conduct. One of the elements of that is arguing detention. That's a general definitional section that applies to all other criminal law codes. The specific provision says you cannot be charged with escape if you're on parole. I don't think you ignore it, but I think you have to give effect to that statutory provision. There are other conditions of release that you can't be prosecuted for the escape without this change. So I think it was very clear what they were trying to do. They made a specific exception because of the other penalties that people had. And, you know, my time is just about up. How we do with Mr. Gamso now, he's interested in the balance of the argument.
Thank you, Mr. Clark. Mr. Gamso.
Say that? I don't know if it does say that. It says who may, those in custody, considered, these folks are to be considered in custody and be charged with escape. They accept, but does it say parolees in detention may not? I don't know whether it says that.
What it said was that a parolee or releasee other than a person who is released on parole or shop parole or
right.
Something else, conditional pardon. Such a person is in custody.
Is considered to be.
Get to custody in a minute. Mm-hmm. Such a person is in custody and
maybe.
And may be charged with escape. Specifically excluding from that category as relevant here parole base.
But does that say parolees who are, forgetting the custody and detention issue, does it say parolees may not?
If you look at the next subsection, 4967D, which immediately follows C2.
Mm-hmm.
It says that a person who's parolee, parolee, or other releasing and so forth into Wisconsin may be charged with parole violation. Neither section, nowhere in the revised code, as it existed during the window of this case, these cases, does it specifically address the question of whether a parolee may be charged with escape. The escape statute does not say, and parolees may be charged with escape. The parole statute does not say, in so many words, and parolees may not be charged with escape. But having listed in the parole statute those persons who may be charged with escape, specifically exempting parolees, and having listed in the escape statute parolees as persons who may be charged with parole violations, are doing precisely the same thing. It seems to me that it is exceeding the bounds of reasonable caution to say that parolees may not be charged with escape, that the statute did not prohibit the charging of parolees with escape.
Do you think that the difference between the words considered to be in custody and detention is unimportant?
I think it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter when we're talking about, because the conflict is not precisely between detention on the one hand for parolees and custody on the other. It's between detention and the context of the escape statute. The conflict is, on the one hand, they can be charged with escape, on the other hand, they can't. And that's the conflict. Whether they're in custody or detention is essentially, it seems to me, irrelevant to that conflict. And it's not the case that Mr. Baum has tried to explain, that is, that the escape statute is equally specific or equally general, or the parole statute equally general, because they both deal with parolees and escapees. In fact, the escape statute is about escape, conflict. The parole statute addresses specifically the context of parolees and escape.
Let's assume their argument about 151, 152 is correct, just for purposes of argument. Does 2901.04 trump 151, 152?
I think that there's a very good argument to be made that it does. I would submit to this court that it should. They are all okay.
Because if we do that, we never get beyond, to me at least, 2901.04.
I think that's right. Once again, if we apply, and unfortunately in resolving this, it may be necessary to look at the rules of construction and say, what do you do when statutes lead you in different directions? Now, within the criminal code, the rules of construction are set out in 2901. 2901.04 tells us what to do when we are trying to interpret statutes setting forth criminal offense and setting forth criminal penalty.
Of course, 2901.04 would apply to both the escape and the parole sections.
That's correct. And it says we construe liberally in favor of the defendant strictly against the state. By the same token, if we want to look at that as simply another one of the rules of construction and say, well, how do we choose this rule of construction to follow if they might lead us in different directions? Then we would say, well, this is the one that specifically applies to criminal cases, as opposed to the general rules of construction set out in Chapter 1 of the revised code, I guess, that apply to all cases. This is the specific, that's the general, we follow the specific. So I think for the same reasons, or for multiple reasons, we get to the same place, 2901.04a controls. The conflict that we have here understanding of the statutes, there's a conflict. The rules of construction lead us finally, if we're going to get beyond 2901.04, to the question of, does the later enactment, the change effective October 4th, 96, trump the change effective July 1, 96?
Or explain it.
Well, it doesn't.
Trumpet means would be negating the prior.
It would be negating a portion of it. If, in fact, on October 4th, escape became charged, or parolees who escaped became charged with absconding became charged with escape, and if, as reenacted on July 1, 96, as part of SB 2, parolees could not be charged with escape, if those things are in conflict, then, yeah, the October change is the later change, but to find the manifest intent of the legislature to be that we should apply that later change seems to me there's nothing in the Bill of Rights that there's nothing in the law that indicates that that is manifest. And we have a clear legislative statement effective March 17th, 1998, that says from now on, people who abscond from parole can't be charged with escape. We have another rule of statutory construction that says the legislature does not intend to do vain acts. The legislature is intended to be meaningful.
You just about three sentences ago, and I need to go back to that, would you say Senate Bill 2 does to this? I thought that the law today is that if you break detention, parolees can be charged with escape.
Yes. That's
okay.
Correct. If I said otherwise,
oh, all
right. Yes. Effective March 17, 1998, they can be. There seems to be no question
okay.
about that.
So then we would get to none of the rules of construction. The state wins.
Today, yes.
If we had the other two statutes as they were, the defendant wins.
Right.
The only reason we're here is because it's a tie.
It's a 17-month statutory window.
It's a tie.
There aren't a whole lot of people that issued your rights, so I don't know the answer to that around the state. It can't be an enormous number. 17-month statutory window. Keep it open so that they can try and move that time into this time is to torture the language of the law and torture cases.
Thank you. Thank you, Gansa. Mr. Cummings, you use your time for me to take that.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, I just want to make two quick points. First of all, Justice Cook, in response to your question, I believe the problem with the tension between detention and custody is in 2967 that the term custody is not defined in the definitional section, so I think everybody's been giving it its customary and usual meaning and equating it with detention in that sense. But let me move on to the main issue. We do have rules of construction here for this court to consider, and I guess depending upon the one you choose to hang your hat on, you can be led down different roads. But I think this court need only look to its own decisions for guidance in a case like this. And this court has said, again, in State v. Wilson and State v. SR, that the primary goal of statutory construction, and this means the 1.51s or the 2967s or whatever, the primary goal of statutory construction is to give effect to the intent of the legislature. So, Your Honors, I think this case is going to have to rise and fall on what you as a body feel the legislature is intended by redefining that detention section in the revised code. It's the state's position that this is clearly a purposeful deletion, as this court has held in the past, and that the legislature's intent is indeed confirmed by the March 98 amendment of the oversight of the parole statute. I'm afraid the Court of Appeals in our district, their interpretation of the statute frustrates the legislature's intent. And I think what the defense is asking you to do here is kind of put you in a difficult position of telling the legislature that it didn't really mean what it did mean, and what it confirmed that it meant, but went ahead and made that amendment in March 28.
You've used your time, John.
No, that's all I have.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. We'll take a brief recess.
All right.